All right, so I'm going to take us in a different direction here for a moment. It was the 27th of July on Thursday, and I was driving in the car and I heard the news. It was shortly after the stock markets opened. And for the very first time in his life, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, had climbed to the top of the world's richest person list. His company, Amazon, which he founded, he owns about 80 million shares of Amazon. And Amazon stock kept climbing so that over the last 3 months or so, his personal wealth had climbed about $10 billion. And so the stock market opened and Amazon climbed, and so his wealth climbed, and he climbed up to right around $91 billion. That was his value. And he surpassed Bill Gates, who was coming in at a very pitiful and paltry only $90 billion. Well, as stock markets go, by the end of the day, that climb of Amazon went back down. And so once again, Bill Gates was at the top, and Jeff Bezos was now just under $90 billion. And I don't know how anyone is expected to live on just under $90 billion. So it was a hard blow for him. But I ended up looking, and I read an article. This was a 2016 Forbes list that said as of 2016, there were more than 1,800 billionaires in the world. More than 1,800 billionaires, billionaire with a B, billionaire. In fact, it also said that those slightly more than 1,800 billionaires owned more wealth than about half of the world. Their combined wealth was more than about half of the world. And nearly two-thirds of the people on their list was what Forbes described as self-made. Now, I always think that's kind of an interesting description because no one is self-made all by themselves. But what they mean by that description is they did not inherit most of their wealth. It was through some idea that they had, some creation that they had, some contacts that they had, and some luck that they had, and a whole lot of hard work that they had, that they made most of their wealth. And Jeff Bezos was on that list. Then in 1994, he was a hedge fund manager when he heard a report that the annual web growth for things to do with the web was about 2,300%. He decided, I'm in the wrong line of work. And he moved from New York out to Seattle, and he started this little online bookstore. You remember when Amazon was just a bookstore? Bill Gates was on the list. Dropout from Harvard, who along with Paul Allen started Microsoft, the idea of a computer in every home. Warren Buffett was on the list, the world's most famous investor. Now, he wasn't born into poverty, but he earned his money not from inheritance, but from investments. He bought his first stock at the age of 11. Europe's richest man, Amancio Ortega, he worked in a shirt-making factory or shop as a kid, and then he started bringing women together and organizing, and then eventually he launched his own store, and today he's worth about $67 billion. Now, one of the most famous rags-to-riches stories in Asia is a man named Li Ka Shing in Hong Kong. And he had to go to work at a young age to help support his family. And he went to a plastic factory. And slowly he started to climb the ladder. And then slowly he launched his own business. And now he's worth somewhere in the $30, $35 billion range. In Arkansas, has some of those stories. And one of our favorite sons and the most familiar story for a lot of people is Sam Walton and the company he founded. And some of you may not know that he grew up on a farm in Oklahoma, and they lived through the Great Depression, and in order to help his family, they milked cows, and he would drive the milk out to customers, and he delivered newspapers and sold magazines. But at 26, he was managing a variety store, which is what they described it as. And then he eventually decided to use money he got from the army and a loan from his father-in-law, and he bought a variety store, and he eventually changed that around to become what we know in Walmart and Sam's Club. Now, I tell those stories because those kinds of stories for a long time have been the kinds of stories that are deep in the heart of what we sometimes describe as the American dream, right? It is that story of starting small but dreaming big. And in many ways, we have to acknowledge that that's not just an American dream. That is the global dream, the self-made person dream, the rags-to-riches dream. Those are what we describe and what we celebrate as good stories. And we like those all across the board in life. We like those stories of the person who went to college and wanted to play ball, and they could only make it as a walk-on. But through a lot of hard work, they eventually make it on the field, maybe even earn a scholarship. Those are good stories. We like the Tom Brady type of stories. I don't like Tom Brady quite as much as I used to, kind of tired of him, but we like those kinds of stories. The guy who so many people passed up, didn't get drafted until the late rounds, but then he goes on to enormous success. Those are good stories. We like the stories in the entertainment world of hearing about someone, a singer who's discovered while singing at the mall, or an actor who's discovered while they're working behind the counter at a fast food restaurant. Those are good stories. Those are the kinds of stories that are woven deep into the desires of people all around us and maybe in here as well. Those are the kinds of stories that we long for, that we work for, the kind that we often want for ourselves and for our kids. They are the stories of upward trajectory. And the more you have to overcome to get there, the more compelling the story becomes. When someone rises from rags to riches, we say, that's a good story. Or when someone goes from obscurity to celebrity, we say, that's a good story. And when someone goes from a nobody to a somebody, we say, that's a good story. But have you ever noticed that with the Jesus story, it is the polar opposite? That in fact, Jesus resists and even reverses those impulses and invites us to follow him on a path with a very different focus in mind. In Acts 4, Jesus is described as God's holy servant, but we know it's not just a name that he receives, it is his very way of life. We know that he's got other names, lofty names, King of Kings and Lord of Lords and the Son of God. But in Mark 10:45, Jesus makes it clear he did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's what makes his not necessarily the good stories, that show up on a Lifetime movie, but a God story. It's in Philippians 2 where Paul says that Jesus has the full and complete God thing going on. He isn't kind of sort of God. He isn't diet God or God-like. He is God in every way. And yet he did not cling to all the perks and privileges that comes with that. Rather, in Philippians 2:7, he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant and being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. That's what takes it from a good story to a God story. And that's the impulse behind one of the most powerful stories in Scripture in John 13. And you can open up your Bible, turn there. John 13 marks a major turning point in the Gospel of John. That throughout the Gospel up until this point, we've been told Jesus' time had not yet come. His time had not yet come. But here in chapter 13, things turn. And it says, Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end, to full completion, to fulfillment. One translation says, he showed them the full extent of his love. Now, when I hear that description, I don't know about you, but when I hear that description, that Jesus is going to love to the full extent of his love, to completion, to the end, it makes me sit up and take notice. Well, what's he going to do? How's he going to show that? How is that going to play out? And we know eventually where that leads. In the end, it leads to a cross. But it starts here with a towel. Jesus humbles himself, and he takes the towel of a servant, and he washes He washes the feet of the disciples. You see where I got duh feet there, disciples and feet. Everyone's tracking with me, okay. So in case you didn't know it, in the ancient world, foot washing was a way to welcome one's guests. Travelers wore sandals, open shoes, and there were dusty roads, and they did not wear socks with their sandals, which is, by the way, public service announcement, the way sandals are designed to be worn. I just wanted to get that out there. That's a freebie. But if you're wearing these open shoes, these sandals on hot, dusty roads, then it is going to make your feet, and this is in the Greek, nasty. And so common courtesy when someone comes to the house is you make a bowl available for them to wash their feet. But if you are wealthy, and not everyone had servants, but if you're wealthy enough to have servants, then that's something you have your servants do. They wash the feet of your guest. And yet it was considered such a menial task that in Jewish households, if you had Jewish servants, that was considered a little below them. That was only reserved for the Gentile servants. This is one of those tasks that is for the lowest of the low, and yet here Jesus is taking a towel in the middle of the meal, not before everything starts, but in the middle of the meal and washing the feet of his disciples. The master becomes a servant. Now, just for fun, as I was preparing for this sermon, I decided to Google that phrase and see what would pop up. The master becomes the servant. And I found something interesting. Maybe you've experienced this from time to time. When you type something in on Google and you're looking for something and Google thinks you've got what you've entered wrong. Have you had that? where Google is like, I see what you wrote, but surely you didn't mean that. And so let me make suggestions as to what I think you were getting at. So I typed in, when master becomes servant, and all the entrants that came up on the first page, except someone who had done a sermon that it referenced, were the reverse of that. When the servant becomes the master. Because that's the story we're more interested in, right? The upward trajectory. The rags to riches. From obscurity to celebrity. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're longing for. That's the kind of thing that we put our effort into. Who chooses regression when you can choose progression? Who goes for demotion if you can choose advancement? Who takes Baltic Avenue if you've got Boardwalk right there waiting for you? Well, Jesus does. That's the Jesus story. The Lord of Lords did that. The Master purposefully, to show the full extent of his love, became the servant. And notice the mindset that helps Jesus get there. I want you to look at verse 3. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God, and he was returning to God. One of the first steps to service is knowing exactly who we are in God. Because the humility required for service will always be harder to attain if we lack a proper sense of identity. If we think we have to prove ourselves. If we think we are above that, that we're better than that, or at least I'm better than them, so they should be the one serving me. And Jesus shows us something else, and perhaps the most challenging of all. Consider for a moment whose feet he's washing. Now, in some ways, we would say it is natural to do those difficult acts of service to those in our life with whom we are closest. And in some ways, it is the most natural. But let's be honest, sometimes it's the people we're around the most that are the hardest to serve on a regular basis. Think about the people that he's serving, the disciples, who are a frequent source of frustration through his life. And think about what he knows is about to happen. This is right near the end. He knows that almost everyone in that room is about to abandon him. And he washes their feet anyway. He lets us know that he knows that Peter is about to deny him. And he insists to Peter, despite Peter's protest, that he washes his feet anyway. He knows, sitting around that table is Judas, who is about to betray him. If it were me, I'd be, loves me, loves me not. Judas, I don't think so. But he washes his feet anyway. Sometimes the hardest people to serve are those we know the best. Because we've got a running tally in our head of the wrongs, of the slights, of the hurts. Or we've got a running tally that I've served my husband 10 times today and he hasn't done a thing for me. Or we work up a little quid pro quo in our mind. Oh, I'll serve my wife, but I'm expecting a little something in return. We know the game, and we've all played it from time to time. And good relationships do have that give and take, but true service doesn't keep records. And it's not given so that it will be returned. In fact, Jesus demonstrates and teaches over and over that we're supposed to be the kind of people that invite others to our dinner table and parties who we know cannot pay us back, who can't give as we've given, that we give freely, and that's what Jesus models. He knows that the people he's come to live for and die for, many of them will be screaming for his head before the end of the week. And he loves them, and he dies for them, and he dies for us anyway. I don't know that this vision that Jesus lays out will ever catch on as the dominant narrative of what life is all about in our culture, because we are still going to privilege these stories of going from little to going to much. And yet Jesus says, if you want to be my disciple, I want you to follow me on the downward way. And there will be some who have a lot of money and some who have a little money along that way, but that is not the goal. There will be some who are recognized by many, and there will be some who are only known by a few, but that is not the goal. The goal is that in all that we are servants. We don't just serve from time to time. It is our identity, because it was his identity. And so this is how the story ends. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. Do you understand what I've done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I've set an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth. No servant is greater than his master, nor is the messenger greater than the one who sent him. He's saying, guess what? I'm still the master. You're still the servant. And yet the servant has become the master. So now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. Blessed because we are a blessing. Lifted up because we humble ourselves. Special because we are servants. That's what makes our stories more than just good stories. That's what makes our stories God's stories.